It's much needed backing from a key ally of Ukraine, along with a welcome photo op for a president who's under pressure back at home. After a gas deal with Greece, Volodymyr Zelensky signing a 10-year military pact with France, far, very far from Kyiv, where corruption scandals brought down two ministers and has the main backer of his 2019 campaign on the run. A respite from the political storm back home and a timely morale boost for a nation that needs all the support it can get at a time when the U.S. is scaling back its commitment to the continent, Russia's advances in the east coming, with the nightly poundings targeting electricity supply and other critical infrastructure. So what does the deal with France bring beyond fighter jet sales? Can EU allies band together on defense? And what does a 10-year deal mean when there's a presidential election here in France in 18 months, one where the pro-Kremlin far right currently leads in the polls? Today in the France 24 debate, we're talking about air cover for Ukraine. With us, she's a former political officer at NATO, Samantha de Benen, associate fellow at the think tank Chatham House. Thanks for joining
us. Good evening.
From Kyiv, Daria Kalinuk, executive director of the Ukrainian Anti-Corruption Action Center Watchdog Group. Welcome back to the show.
Good evening.
From Berlin, where France's president will travel on Tuesday, more on that later, correspondent Nick Holdsworth, good to see you.
Evening.
Also in the German capital, he served at Austria's Ministry of Defense in a previous life, Gustav Gressel, former senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
You can always listen, that's right, listen to the France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. Yeah, the Coalition of the Willing has a command center, and it's on the heights above the west of Paris. Emmanuel Macron giving the grand tour to Volodymyr Zelensky inside the future offices for the 34-nation coalition that's ready and willing to step in to enforce an eventual ceasefire. The Mont-Valérien military base visit sandwiched between lunch at the presidential palace and the earlier signing of a letter of intent on a 10-year defense pact. And just to make the optics obvious, that is indeed a Rafale fighter jet that you see, one of more than 100 that could be delivered over the next decade, on top of the F-16s from other allies, more recently, Swedish Gripen military planes pledged for Ukraine.
There is a strong defense package, support for Ukraine, there is Rafale, and I am sure that this is a historic decision. And what can strengthen us? I will tell you that this is a very serious fleet that we are building for Ukraine.
Samantha de Benen, what do you make of this announcement and this fleet that you heard Volodymyr Zelensky describing that's coming together?
Well, it's a very strong political signal from France. France is saying we are going to be by your side for the next 10 years at least, because this is a 10-year deal. The problem I have with this deal is that Ukraine needs weapons now, weapons that exist now. This letter of intent that was signed is for planes, is for air defense systems, is for drones. None of these weapons actually exist. Now, some of them will be able to be put into production very fast and delivered within 6 months, 18 months, but that doesn't change the fact that Ukraine needs air defense today, it needs planes today, because what Ukraine will be left, and I'm sorry to be so pessimistic, in 3, 5, or 10 years' time, when these weapons are eventually delivered. So this agreement has been hailed as historic. It's a very strong political signal that is sent to Russia, that's obviously sent to the Ukrainians, that's sent to European allies, that's sent to the United States. But is it going to change anything today on the battlefield when Ukraine really, really needs it? I'm afraid not. What would change things on the battlefield would be the sky shield. A no-fly zone. Doesn't have to even be over the whole country, but over part of the country. There are initiatives in France and in the UK, citizens, petitions that have been signed. Polls in France show that 68% of the population would actually be in favor of European, French, other European air defense and planes protecting Western Ukraine. Where are Where is the sky shield? Where are measures that will be put in place today so that Ukraine is still free and whole to receive those Rafales in 3 or 10 years' time?
Now, in the headlines this Monday, the USS Gerald Ford, the United States' most advanced warship, deployed amid a buildup of off Venezuela after traveling from the Mediterranean. That leaves the U.S. with a grand total of 0 aircraft carriers currently in Europe. Some saying they don't remember a time when there were no aircraft carriers in Europe. Can Gustav Gressel, can you have Sky Shield if you don't have the Americans?
Well, it's a tricky question, because the problem of the American role is not that they urgently need to provide aircraft, and in this occasion, actually, an aircraft carrier, which is not allowed to enter the Black Sea via the Turkish Strait, would be the least use. But the issue with the American participation in any interim force or Sky Shield would be the ultimate guarantor that if Russia strikes, for example, an airbase in Romania with Western planes or European planes patrolling over Ukraine, that this would be regarded as Article 5, and that any fights between European and Russian troops that occur out of obligations for Ukraine would be regarded as Article 5. That would provide
Article 5, an attack against one is an attack against all in NATO.
Yes, an attack, even if Ukraine is not allied territory, if you have planes in Poland, Poland is allied territory. But of course, Article 5 then always needs to be decided upon, and there needs to be a clear vision on what and kind of what circumstances lead to it. Without that, of course, a lot of countries are hesitant. They fear Russian escalation. And as we saw over the past 3.5 years of war, that kind of saber-rattling on Moscow's side unfortunately works quite well in Europe, especially in Germany, I have to say.
Nick Holdsworth, you have, this Monday, the news that there was overnight sabotage of the main rail line between Warsaw and the Polish city of Lublin, a key line for providing aid for Ukraine. The Poles, their suspicions turning to Russia and Belarus. Is that an Article 5 situation? And do you agree with Gustav Gressel that there's still a lot of hesitancy where you are?
Well, first of all, taking the second question first, there is certainly hesitancy in Berlin, in Paris, as we've seen in London too. And Keir Starmer is going to be in Berlin tomorrow with President Macron as well. I mean, the problem is, and it was alluded to there just now, is that the Europeans have been hesitant all along. I mean, ever since Putin invaded Ukraine on the 24th of February 2022, the Europeans have been dragging their feet to help Ukrainians, and nobody in Europe seems to understand. I don't really get it. They don't understand that the only language Vladimir Putin understands is force. And if he'd been slapped down right at the very beginning, if they'd closed the skies over Ukraine in the first week, believe me, this would have been over a long time ago. The only language a bully understands is a sharp punch on the nose. Now, coming back to your first question, we can't say whether that sabotage, suspected sabotage of the railway tracks in Poland, could trigger Article 5, because it's not proven who those were behind it. If it is proven that that was a Russian or a Belarusian activity, then that does beg the question, is this enough to trigger Article 5? But given the state of the European allies in the EU and the wider region on the Kremlin's activities, I suspect, no, that they wouldn't trigger Article 5 over that, because they've been too timorous, just too timorous, the entire 3.5 years, coming on 4 years now, as Ukraine has suffered and bled for European freedom.
If viewers haven't noticed, Nick is also our former Moscow correspondent. Daria Kalyanuk, let me ask you, so getting back to our top line here, what's been announced here in Paris, is it underwhelming? Is it a morale boost? What's your reaction?
Thank you for the question. My key answer is actually who will pay for that deal, because we are not talking about the delivery of aid. We are talking about possibility for Ukraine to buy 100 jets in a 10-year period. And now Ukraine is in the situation when we have to fight the war, and we don't have money for that. And I always believed and still believe that the one who has to pay for all that is Russia. Make Russia pay is our campaign, and unfortunately, there is still no decision about this reparation loan, which should be linked to money kept in Belgium, in Euroclear. This is Russian money. It's about 200 billion kept in Europe, even more. And we had, we still have hopes in Ukraine that based on this money, there will be created financial tool to send to Ukraine in the form of a loan or whatever, which will help us to sustain both our economy and our defense. And you know, I would like to refer to the first speaker, expert, who said that Ukraine needs to survive now. This is now when Russia is firing literally every week 500 drones combined with ballistic missiles and Iskanders. And I live in Kyiv, so I sleep with my kids in the corridor. Sometimes the windows are shaking, and I don't know what's going to be next, whether we will have the air defense. And in a month, there could be 1,000 of Russian drones. And you can't stop this 1,000 Russian drones only with fighter jets, which will arrive in 10 years or in 5 years. We need to have solutions right away. And Ukraine has some innovative solutions, also anti-drone innovative solutions. So we need money also to scale up our production here for some innovations.
It's been, yeah, as you describe it, another one of those nights across Ukraine. We had a vessel carrying liquefied natural gas that was damaged during a Russian attack near Odessa, while the southern port there suffered damage. Elsewhere, rail lines damaged, power cut, at least 5 killed, including 3 in a strike in the northeast Kharkiv region city of Balaklia. And as Moscow claims to have seized 3 more villages at the front, it's using infiltration tactics now to seal the capture of the eastern logistics hub of Pokrovsk. Oliver Farry has more.
It's an online video that stunned Ukraine. A procession of armed men emerging from the fog. They're Russian soldiers entering Pokrovsk in the Donbass. A surreal scene in which troops are perched on civilian motorcycles. Others behind the wheels of battered doorless cars. Some even advance on foot. The aim is to move as discreetly as possible so as not to be noticed by drones or US intelligence satellites. The Russian military has learned the lesson from these tanks being systematically destroyed by the Ukrainians. In response, they now send troops ahead in small groups, like here, where 2 soldiers tried to infiltrate Ukrainian defenses on foot.
There are more and more small groups of saboteurs trying to advance and infiltrate our positions. It's hard to detect them all.
In another video, a Russian soldier can be seen running through a field. It's a tactic that is allowing Moscow to make gains in the Donbass in the direction of Pokrovsk, a mining town where fighting has been continuing for more than 12 months and which is now almost completely surrounded by the Russian army.
Patrols arrive in the city and they deliberately disperse and hide, usually hiding in cellars. They await the signal for regrouping, at which point they form a unit.
For now, Ukraine denies Pokrovsk has been surrounded and has released this video of 2 Russian military vehicles being destroyed at the approach to the city.
Gustav Gressel, how do you counter that infiltration tactic?
Well, the problem is usually it's countered by putting more infantry to the line and providing the line with more infantry to the rear to have a depth in defense. The problem is Ukraine can't afford that because they have insufficient infantry. So Ukrainian troops try to improvise by drones, aerial drones, ground vehicles, radio-controlled ones. The problem is, of course, they're depending on the dependent on the weather. They're dependent on EW situation, and there is a range advantage that you have if you're fighting close to your own rear, which in Pokrovsk, but as a kind of Ukrainian pocket, sort of that reaches into territory otherwise held by Russian occupiers, this range advantage belongs to Moscow. And that's why for them it's easier there actually to progress. Pokrovsk, especially the adjacent cities there, are in a very, very difficult spot for Ukrainian defenders to hold.
Daria Kalinuk, we're heading towards winter. What are you expecting in the months ahead?
I expect more attacks on critical energy infrastructure, more combined strikes with missiles and drones. Russia successfully hit a couple of times our critical infrastructure already this autumn. We regularly have electricity cuts. I don't have heat at home yet. Some heating systems were damaged as well. So the strategy of Russia is to turn Ukraine into an unlivable place, and we already survived a couple of winters, and this winter will be one of the hardest, because basically Russians learned even how to bypass the sophisticated air defense, like Patriots, some T's and others, and having possibility to scale up the drones production, they just can fire hundreds of drones overnight and penetrate air defense. So we have to adapt and adjust, be innovative, and even existing Western and NATO solutions against that kind of scale of attacks, they are not fit to this kind of war. Russia learns, and I think that's example when Russia successfully sent its drones into the Polish territory, and finally Polish fighter jets started to shoot down Russian drones, but it is very expensive and it's not very effective. And I think that for our allies in Europe, it is important to reconsider its air defense, not rely only to fighter jets, but also to drones, and have lessons learned from Ukraine.
Now, Samantha De Bendren, in the mix of this deal that was signed are these French anti-missile systems that are going to be ready for use next year, says Paris. Is that more in line with what Daria is saying rather than expensive sorties for airplanes?
Yes, absolutely. One of the problems that, for instance, Poland faced when it was invaded by these 19 drones is that it used F-16s or F-35s, I can't remember which, but these are planes that are worth tens of millions of euros or dollars against drones that are worth 10 to 15,000. So it is a very ineffective way to shoot down drones. You can shoot down drones without having to spend a lot of money, but you need to have the munitions, you need to have the missiles. Sometimes drones are actually shot down with rifles if they come down very low. And
you heard Daria Kalinuk saying how the Ukrainians too are scaling
up. Yeah.
Are the rest of the Europeans scaling up?
The Ukrainians produce a lot more drones than anyone else in Europe combined, because they have to. The Ukrainians have shown the most incredible inventivity during this war. They are now producing their own missiles, the Flamingo missile, which goes further and carries a heavier payload than the famous US Tomahawk. This is something that is produced inside Ukraine using spare parts that are made in Ukraine, and it is a completely hermetically sealed Ukrainian chain of supply chain. So yeah, the Ukrainians are scaling up. They have no choice. This is their survival. In France and in the rest of Europe, we're beginning to start producing a bit more. We're beginning to increase our defense budgets. We talked about the MAMBA SMTP air defense systems, which are kind of sort of equivalent of the US Patriot system. France has 8. Ukraine needs 12 Patriot-type systems to protect its territory. What can France give today? And that is the question that all European countries are facing in terms of their own air defence, is that they hardly have enough to protect their own territory. So what can they give to Ukraine? The ones who are in the best position right now to help Ukraine immediately would be the Germans with the Taurus missiles. But for some reason, that there is still a blockage in delivering those. But yeah, Ukrainian has scaled up. The Russians have scaled up. We are still waiting for somehow the war in Ukraine to end and for this whole nightmare to just go away. But it's not going to go away. And as your correspondent in Berlin said, Putin only understands one kind of language, that is the language of strength and the language of determination. And we haven't showed that in Europe.
All right, the Taurus is aside. There is more and more work afoot to have a joint production in Europe. We saw that joint command center at the outset that Volodymyr Zelensky got to visit in the west of Paris. And, you know, all this talk about fighter jets. When it comes to the French and their fighter jets, a lot revolves around the Rafale. It's the product of a family-owned company called Dassault. Dassault with a very different corporate culture to European consortium Airbus. So much so that 100 billion euro plans for a FCAS, Future Combat Air Systems fighter jet, are teetering on the brink, according to Financial Times. So different is the corporate culture that Dassault chief executive Eric Trappier has reportedly shrugged off threats by the Germans to instead partner with the Swedes or the British. A French bank close to the situation said the only salvation for FCAS now is if Macron twists Trappier's arms again. This is this executive at Dassault. Right now, the deal is totally immobilized and close to dead. Nick Holdsworth, a fly on the wall in Tuesday's meeting between the French president and the German chancellor. What will he or she hear?
Well, it's quite possible that the French and Germans are going to talk about scrapping the whole FCAS program altogether. I mean, it's been said that this is a dispute between companies rather than between governments. And the Germans and the French, particularly the Germans, are keen to talk about AI-assisted cloud system, which would rapidly spread information to European fighter jets, to their pilots in the skies, to make European defences more effective with what they already have, rather than just creating more hardware. So it's quite possible that is going to be on the agenda. Certainly the FT article is sounding pretty much on the money here in Berlin today.
Gustav Gressel, what are you expecting from Tuesday's sit-down?
Well, I expect actually to be FCAS as a program to be either stopped or completely reformed. I don't see the two industrial positions of EADS and Dassault coming together. On the other hand, is it really necessary? Actually, the Rafale is a result of a previous attempt to force marriage the German and the French aircraft industry, and it didn't work. The other thing is, what can you do with all the project and R&D investment that surrounds the project? Is the fighter jet really the essential thing? Is the drone and combat information system research, is that not the core of it? And can you do a division of labor in that actually satisfies both French and German industry and at least produces a product of different entrepreneurs, but that are interoperable when it comes to the common defense? That's actually the serious question, and not who is sort of in charge of producing a prestige thing.
All right, so less could be more, and this flows with what we were talking about earlier about the need for the anti-drone or drone capability, as we've been seeing with this conflict. In his remarks, the French president dangling, by the way, the prospect of EU membership for Ukraine, with a nod to those urging Volodymyr Zelensky to make a clean break with those in his inner circle tainted by a corruption scandal back home in Kyiv.
I would like to conclude by underlining once again that Ukraine belongs to the European family, not only in terms of its geography, but also in terms of its values, its history and its courage. The path of the European Union will be demanding. It will require deep efforts and reforms, especially in terms of the rule of law, transparency, governance and the fight against corruption. I trust the determination of the Ukrainian people to carry this out, and I trust President Zelensky to do so.
Daria Kalinuk, does that sound like an endorsement or a warning to Ukraine's president?
I think it's a kind of encouragement coming from a friend. Emmanuel Macron is a friend with Volodymyr Zelensky. And I hope that in the non-public private meeting there was more to discuss. Because Ukrainian resilience depends on ability of our institutions to carefully do their work for the country. And our anti-corruption bodies revealed a large-scale corruption, which engages inner circle of President Zelensky. And this is corruption which touches critical energy infrastructure. For all Ukrainians, it was a very unpleasant thing to hear, to observe. This is so-called Mindichgate investigation because of the name of Timur Mindich, a former business partner of Volodymyr Zelensky and his friend. So it's good that our anti-corruption bodies revealed this scheme and stopped it. And now two ministers resigned as a result of this investigation, but it's not over yet. I think that Volodymyr Zelensky has to look very closely into his closest inner circle, starting from Chief of Staff Andriy Yermak, who is functioning in Ukraine like vice president. So it's not constitutionally the powers which he holds, but he's de facto influencing most of the HR positions in the country, including positions of various ministers, deputy ministers. And I think for me, for a person as a Ukrainian and a person who is dealing with fighting corruption for many years and who is in depth of all this problems inside the country, I think until Zelensky will keep Andriy Yermak as his chief of staff, he will not learn the lessons. And if there will be more attempts from Zelensky to attack anti-corruption bodies, like there was attempt in summer, that would be also for me the clear signal that Volodymyr Zelensky didn't learn his lesson and didn't listen to his friend Emmanuel Macron.
That's, by the way, a charge that's been leveled a lot at Emmanuel Macron. He had a chief of staff, Alexis Kohler, and then he said, Kohler is more than just the gatekeeper to the president. He's got too much influence, too much power. You really think that the top advisor there, Andriy Yermak, is at the heart of the problem?
Yes, I think so. I believe so. And unfortunately, President Zelensky outsourced a lot of decisions about how he governs the country to this man. And Zelensky enjoys a full majority in parliament. And it means that there is no proper restriction, no proper system of checks and balances. The parliament cannot properly, you know, balance huge power of Zelensky, which he even increased because of the war, because of the martial law. And that are two reasons why the inner circle of Zelensky is getting stronger and why Andriy Yermak de facto has more power than the prime minister of Ukraine. And because he decides who is the prime minister of Ukraine. It's the fact. And for Ukrainians who voted for Zelensky, still support them. We didn't vote for Yermak, who is the vice president, and who actually failed his job of being a good manager of the country, which led to such kind of outrageous corruption in the critical energy infrastructure. And NABU is also investigating the defense sector, and there might be continuations. So for Zelensky, he needs to change the way how he is managing internally the country, not through this one manager or the five inner circle managers, but through people who are independent, professional. It's important to give them subjectivity, so that they are not doing only something that Andriy Yermak tells them or the president tells them.
Samantha Nabender, here in France during World War I, we had a state of emergency. There were no elections the whole time of the war. Democracy during wartime.
Well, it's difficult. And I think that each case is different. I mean, in the UK, there was a big scandal during World War I as well, when Lord Asquith ended up having to resign because of some procurement problems, some ammunition procurement problems. And he went.
It's always procurement.
Yeah, always procurement. So it wasn't actually a suggestion of corruption, but it was just inappropriate procurement. Obviously, democracy, war and democracy do not go very well together. Right now, I still think that Ukraine needs President Zelensky for the simple reason that he is the face that the world knows. He has managed to galvanize so much support for Ukraine internationally. If he were to leave now, if there were to be elections now, first of all, what kind of elections would they be? Who would be able to vote? What territories would be able to vote? How would you actually figure out who's going to be on the electoral register? Russian interference would be enormous. I think it would be a very, very bad thing. But at the same time, President Zelensky clearly has a problem. There clearly is a corruption problem. I'll just remind you that last summer there were efforts to disband the anti-corruption body. The Ukrainian people went out on the street and protested in wartime. They braved the drones. They braved the missiles in central Kyiv, and they protested not against the Russians, but against a decision that their government had made. And the anti-corruption bureau stayed in place. So democracy is still very much alive in Ukraine. The fact that this corruption scandal came out is also a sign that democracy is still alive in Ukraine. There still is a certain separation of powers. It looks bad. But if Ukraine were not a democracy, this would have been kept under wraps in a much more efficient way, the way it is in Russia, for instance. So, yes, it's a shame there are no elections. But elections do not make a democracy. You can have elections in many countries right. Where there's absolutely no democracy. So I would say that the Ukraine's democracy is still strong, and that is what the West is supporting. But of course, after the war is over, a lot of questions are going to be asked. Zelensky is going to have to face some pretty grueling questions, and he might not get re-elected. Look what happened in the UK also after the Second World War. Everybody today idolizes Churchill. He was kicked out more or less immediately after the war ended.
Right. Just a reminder, it's a scandal that had been brewing for 15 months at its center, as described by Daria, Volodymyr Zelensky's former business partner, Timur Mindich, accused in a $100 million embezzlement scheme that allegedly skimmed off the top of defense plans for the country's energy infrastructures, opposition lawmakers posting to social media a gilded toilet with the claim that it's from one of Mindich's opulent Kyiv apartments. Whether or not that is confirmed, the 15-month investigation by prosecutors points to wiretaps where suspects talk openly of money laundering.
This has a very bad effect on the morale of society and the defense forces. The war has been going on for 11 years, and many are fighting and sacrificing their lives and health. But someone is sitting in Kyiv or somewhere else and allows themselves to steal in a war situation. This is treason.
This is treason. Daria Kalyanuk, though, do you take Samantha Nabender's point that right now the world needs Volodymyr Zelensky?
First of all, it is important whether Ukrainian...
Go ahead, Daria Kalyanuk.
Okay. I think it is important whether Ukrainian people need Volodymyr Zelensky. And we do need him because we have voted for him. And he is still a legitimate president. We can't have elections because of the war situation. But it is also important that these are the Ukrainian people who have right and execute its right on asking tough questions to Volodymyr Zelensky. Yes, we are a democracy. And yes, this is how we are different from, let's say, Belarus. There is nothing about corruption in Belarus. There are no anti-corruption bodies in Belarus which are exposing energy sector corruption or defense sector corruption. In Ukraine, we do have these agencies. We built them as part, by the way, of our European integration track, because Ukrainian people, we believe in dignity, we want fair play, we want justice, and we believe in the values which are ground, which European Union has been grounded on. So, and I agree that the fact that we have this scandal is very positive. I'm telling this as a professional person, expert dealing with fighting corruption. And this scandal is happening not from journalists investigating corruption, but actually from independent anti-corruption bodies which are prosecuting corruption and which are procedurally dealing with collecting this evidence. And when there was a time for Volodymyr Zelensky to dismantle these anti-corruption bodies, the young people of Ukraine, these are teenagers, 17, 16 years old, 20, 23 years old young Ukrainians, they stood up and protested and demanded Zelensky to return back to the will of the people. Yes, we are maintaining a democracy. It's much harder during the wartime, but we have to rebuild our and maintain our system of checks and balances. Volodymyr Zelensky also needs to hear its people and to change his five managers on whom he is relying, starting from the manager number one, Andriy Yermak, whom I already mentioned, because it's led to this devastating corruption, which Ukrainian anti-corruption bodies had to record, and they spent 15 months to record that. It means that many money were not spent on time, and defensive constructions in critical energy infrastructure to protect transformers from Russian attacks were not built because of corruption. It means that, you know, in the wartime, especially Ukrainian people are extremely sensitive to this kind of corruption. I'm hearing a lot of questions about Western taxpayers who have to keep supporting Ukraine and sending their money to Ukraine. I'm telling you that Ukrainian taxpayers are more cautious and are more protective about our taxes being paid and about all aid being paid given to Ukraine. Because if something is being misspent, if a single euro has been stolen, it means that the soldier on the front line didn't receive something, or that my kid, which sleeps in the corridor, is not protected from Russian attacks. So, yeah, we are still a democracy, but we are given a tough, hard time to Volodymyr Zelensky. He needs to speak honestly to his people.
Gustav Gressel, tell us how the story is playing where you are in Berlin.
Well, it is, of course, tricky because Ukraine receives a lot of Western funds. Some of these are credits, but some of these are actually donations. And then, of course, the legitimacy of that is questioned. I fully concur with my previous speaker that actually it is a success of anti-corruption bodies. It was difficult to set them up and preserve their independence, and I think it paid off. But nevertheless, of course, there should be critique on Zelensky's management of the government. Of course, he's the legitimate elected leader. And in Germany as well, it is forbidden to hold election during wartime and during martial law. It is common amongst European democracies to have this kind of provision. But unlike other previous wartime leaders, for example, there was never an attempt to form a sort of unity government like in Great Britain during the Second World War, or even Netanyahu attended this in Israel after the October 7th attack. The second thing is that if we look back at the last government reshuffling, we had basically a recycling of officials within the same government, even if some ministers have proven not to be so successful. There was never an attempt to, for example, choose ministers from officials or specialists. At the same time, you have very capable generals resigning from like commander of land forces because they were not able to induce the changes and make the reforms that they deem necessary to fulfill their tasks. So there is a lot of room for improvement. And here, I think the Europeans are in a position where they can demand this kind of improvements from Zelensky.
Nick Holdsworth, this question of transparency at the heart of the 2014 revolution that overthrew the pro-Moscow president, Viktor Yanukovych. Back then, there were also claims, rumors, if you will, of a gilded toilet as well. But this is something ingrained in people that in Ukraine that they demand transparency.
Well, I think that the Ukrainians suffered a lot during the years of Leonid Kuchma in the 90s when Ukrainian corruption was just rife. I was living in Moscow at the time, and the joke was that Ukraine was even more corrupt than Russia. And, you know, they got their house in order a little bit under the predecessors to Yanukovych. And then Yanukovych comes in, and I arrived at his palace just outside of Kiev on the day he fled in 2014, in February 2014, and they'd already shut the place up, and it was fairly well guarded by volunteers. I was able just to get a peek inside between some curtains, and it had the sort of same goldiness, the sort of gold gilt goldiness that you see in Trump's White House. It really seemed like the people were sick of corruption. So this current scandal, to see the kids out on the streets early in the summer when Volodymyr Zelensky was trying to water down the independence of that anti-corruption unit, I mean, that's very important. It's ingrained in the Ukrainians, and particularly in wartime, that you should all pull together. So, I mean, these guys who have allegedly been involved in a 100 million euro corruption scheme, gold toilets, what have you, it's a very, very bad look for Ukraine in the middle of war. One of them's fled, I believe, to Israel. That's Timur Mindich. The others are saying they're going to defend themselves. If they're found guilty, expect extremely long prison terms, because I don't think the Ukrainian people will accept anything less.
Darya Kalyanuk, again, at the same time, in another parallel universe, we talked about at the beginning, you got Ukraine's president in Greece on Sunday, in France on Monday, in Spain on Tuesday. Your thoughts on how he handles himself going forward?
I don't know. We'll see. I think that our partners, particularly the European Union and the EU member states, have their important say, and they have important leverage. The aid, particularly macrofinancial assistance, which is provided to Ukraine, if it is conditional to very precise, concise rule of law and good governance reforms, is helpful for Ukraine. If EU accession is linked to very precise, concise anti-corruption, good governance, rule of law conditionalities, it is good for Ukraine. And the most recent EU accession report for Ukraine highlights everything Ukraine needs to do and which we support. It's like, you know, selection of the prosecutor general based on the merit and based on the very some meaningful competition. It's reboot of other law enforcement agencies. It's very technical, but it's very practical. And I understand that all other reforms like agriculture, energy, environment are complicated to do in order to adhere to the EU standards. But rule of law and good governance reforms during wartime, they are more needed. They are demanded by the people of Ukraine. And it is important they to be demanded by our partners, because in such a way, you are supporting not Zelensky, you are supporting the people of Ukraine. You know, this show has the name Air Cover for Zelensky. We need air cover for Ukraine. We need money for Ukraine in order to pay for this air cover and to pay to our soldiers for defending Ukraine and Europe. And we need reforms for Ukraine, good governance reforms for Ukraine. And this is the best way how to support Ukraine, to be tough on these good governance reforms and mix these reforms with all the financial aid and military aid. This is what makes us stronger from inside. Because, you know, Zelensky can travel all across different countries, but I believe that the solution to this war is inside Ukraine. It is in hands of Ukrainian people. Definitely, we need money in order to sustain our resilience. Therefore, it is important to find the way how to either have reparation loan linked to Russian money. And I believe that Russian money kept in Europe not being used to support Ukraine is a big problem. There is money to fund this war. And our side, our homework in Ukraine is to make sure that this money are being spent effectively, not misspent, not used on some corruption on golden toilets or whatever, but is spent on actually best of the best drones. We need to scale up production of our best electronic warfare technologies, all our digital solutions, drones, much faster than Russia, because Russia is scaling up. It is, and it already entered fully into the war economy. It is synchronizing with China, with North Korea, with Iran. It's learning very fast. It has much more people than us. It doesn't care about its people. It can send the mid-ranger. Our infantry can't be never as big as Russian. But we can't have alone that amount of money as Russia has. So therefore, money from Europe, Russian money from Europe, $200 billion, it's a lot. Demands of reforms from Europe. Mm. For the European integration and for macrofinancial assistance, particularly good governance, rule of law. It could be 10, 15 conditions. We know them, what needs to be done. And we have ability to win this war. We will be stronger and more resilient. And Zelensky needs to learn its lessons and get rid of its rotten inner circle, starting from its chief of staff.
All right, that message is clear. Daria Kalinuk, many thanks for joining us there. From Kyiv, I want to thank as well Nick Holdsworth and Gustav Gressel for being with us from Berlin. Samantha de Benzern, thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.